Hello Year 12, hello VCE students, and welcome to our very first episode of Beyond the Lines. It's Miss Murr here, and I also have Ronnie.
Hello!
And I've got Mrs. Cavillan.
Hi.
And we're going to launch our podcast by celebrating all things Sunset Boulevard. We'll start by talking about the film. And then we'll move on in the second half to a discussion of best approaches to the SAC and the statement of intention, I think, is the plan. Before we start, though, I would like to dedicate the opening of this podcast to our love of Norma Desmond and her passion for the silent film era. So let's do that. Get it? Oh, hilarious.
We're so funny.
Stop it. So let's start with you, Ronnie. What's your talk to me about Sunset Boulevard. Favorite moments?
Well, I love old films, and that comes from my background as someone who studied film while she's at uni. And you know, every time I teach an old film, I just love how things are complicated, but they're done in such a simple manner. And Sunset Boulevard does that. We don't have the bells and whistles that come with the films that we have today. We actually look at film as a construction and the way that the directors viewed it, which I think is so important for you guys to see, because you're so used to these films with special effects and the rest of it, and don't really appreciate the art of filmmaking and the way it used to be. So, you know, when we get to teach films like this, it really excites me, because the acting is pivotal in these sort of films. And that's when you have someone like Norma Desmond, who was a silent, you know, film star, so dependent on her looks and her, you know, facial expressions, that when it came that moment when talking films took over, there was nothing for her to go to, because it wasn't about how she looked anymore. It was about what she said. And, you know, that's why I love her as a character, because she never really overcame that, but she still had that desire to try and get, you know, famous again. So Norma would be my favourite.
She's pretty amazing. What about you, Mrs. Cavillan?
Well, look, from a legal studies teacher's perspective, I think the first thing that hooked me into Sunset Boulevard was the body in the pool. As dark and gloomy as that is, I know for me the fact that there was a sense of mystery around, well, what's happened to Joe Gillis and why. As a bit of a crime buff, that was my in with this text. I'm not as much of a fan of old films as Ronnie is, so that's where I drew my inspiration from. And really getting to follow that narrative with such bonkers scenes, like I'm talking about the chimpanzee, things like that happening in the text, that's what really got me excited about it, where I'm going, what's happening? Why is that happening? And I think by being able to ask myself those questions as an audience member, that's what makes it exciting, and that I think is what makes it great to be studying it as a creative text.
Yeah, and I think I'd probably take a little bit of both of what you said, because I love the style of the film, and I love the tropes of film noir that are referenced, the black and white, the lighting, the richness, the shadows, the drama, and also that kind of really foreboding, sinister sense that things are not quite right. I think you use the word bonkers. I don't think you could get any more accurate with a word than bonkers when you think of Norma Desmond. So the film noir situation, I think, with you know, the old-style films, detective films, crime films, but also her eyes. Oh, my God, those eyes.
The eyes and the hands as well. I think the hands certainly get me as well. That claw-like grasp that you see recurring throughout the film when she's watching films of herself and she stands up and declares her passion for her comeback. She does it. But then also as she romances Joe and she lies with him on the couch and she, you know, leans in and grabs him, just watching the way that without telling what's happening, Billy Wilder is able to show her obsessive and possessive nature. It really, it's really something that I keep coming back to.
And I think that's a good point you made there as well, is that she's not saying it, it's her actions which reflects her ability as this silent film actress, that what she does and her views that she puts forward isn't necessarily said, it's the actions that she does.
Which are really over the top. And I think as well, it's easy to kind of dismiss this, the melodrama of this film as, oh, it's melodramatic because it's an old film and they didn't know how to act or they didn't know how to put together a cinematic experience, so everything's really over the top. But that was a deliberate choice by the director to reference the nature of silent film and the way that everything had to be really blown up on screen in terms of facial expressions and, you know, what you were saying before, Mrs. Cavillan, about hand gestures and all of those things needed to be really over the top to convey meaning because there were no words.
Even the fact that it's filmed in black and white when Billy Wilder did have the option to film this in colour, it's not that old that it had to be filmed that way. But again, just drawing upon the style of silent era films that were black and white. And it did give him the option as well of using more lighting to emphasise things rather than colour. Like, we look back at that scene where Norma appears at Paramount's lot and she sits in DeMille's chair and the three-point lighting is cast upon her. That's so much more effective in black and white, and we can start to unpack the symbolism behind that because it is filmed in this manner. So I think that that's another interesting choice, especially if someone is studying this analytically, not just creatively like we're doing here at this school.
Well, that is one of the symbols of the film itself, is that use of the spotlight on Norma quite a bit of the time. Even when she's going down the stairs at the end, you know, the sort of light is shining on her. When she's looking in the mirror, there's a light on her. So she always feels that she needs to be in that spotlight in order to give her relevance again, which she, you know, in a way feels that she doesn't have towards the end, but the spotlight allows her to think that she does.
Yeah. I think likewise, like contrastingly, the use of shadow is significant in the way it draws out a sense of unease and uncertainty from an audience in response to what they're looking at. You know, if you see half a face, you're compelled to be sort of, what's going on here? Yeah. Questioning and uncertain, which is, again, that sort of film noir detective genre trope with solving the problem of the face.
Yeah,
you know?
And I do like, and it's like two sides to the story, and it shows that the character has, you know, there's aspects of them that we still haven't found out that we could find out. But I was going to say, as to that craziness of the film is the fact that it's narrated by a dead man. It starts off with, you know, Joey lying dead in the pool, and then this is how I came about, which when we're writing creatively, you say, oh, you can't write from the perspective of a dead person, but there's Wilder presenting a film from the perspective of a dead person.
It's a really interesting point, and I think his characterization through voiceover at the start is so different to how he behaves at the start of the film.
Exactly.
So we get a sense of who he's going to become in death from the narration that we don't get from his action.
Yeah.
So again, another moment where we get sound and voiceover offering something to a film that we would not get in a silent era film.
Yeah.
You know, another kind of, I guess, point being conveyed by Wilder is the significance and the meaning, sort of adding value to meaning through the use of sound and narration.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think going back to what you said about shadows as well, I think immediately my mind casts back to one character in particular, which is Max. And I think that it would be great if we could have some discussion
Max.
Around what is Max's role in the film and from our perspective, why do we believe that he's behaved the way he does? Because I know for a few students, they're really interested in Max and they've formed a lot of their creative impressions around him and his character.
I think Max is just as delusional as Norma.
Mm.
I think they're just as crazy as each other.
And both driven by desires of different kinds as well.
Yeah, he wants to still feel relevant. He doesn't have a job, but by trying to make Norma feel like she's still an important actress and she's still got fans behind her sort of gives him
legitimacy.
Exactly. Yeah. I think he's bonkers too. That's our word of the day, bonkers.
I think Joe actually uses the word, you know, batty as well when he first lays eyes upon Max, realizing that this situation is somewhat unusual. But I felt really taken back when there was the big revelation about him being the first husband. Mm. But then I thought back going, well, does it fit? And obviously Wilder's done that for a reason. But the fact that Max still stays, although those romantic feelings have changed for Norma, is very interesting and very different according to the era where you would have not seen the woman as the dominant one in the relationship, whereas in this case she appears to be so.
Mm. But do you think that he's slightly dominant though? Because he sort of narrates her story too. He's sort of directing where she's going.
And you could argue her behaviours have, you know, he's been the catalyst of some of those really eccentric behaviours.
So as much as she is in control, or she thinks she's in control, there are things that he does that directs her to do the things that she ends up doing. So,
and sustains those weird behaviours. So
even at the very end, it's like he's directing her walking down those stairs, you know, and shining the light on her, and the cameras are on her too. So it's like his final stance as a director of her life now. Yeah. So I do think that he's just as much in control than she is.
I think that's really interesting, especially if students are writing creative stories about Max, to not paint him as this lost love interest. It's more complex than that. So I think definitely look into Max's character, and when he does speak and speaks so powerfully, to really take note of what he says, how he says it. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and there's something sinister that sits underneath it all.
Absolutely.
Who else do we need to talk about, do you think?
The monkey. Oh, the chimpanzee. I mean, everyone wants to write from the perspective of the chimpanzee.
And if that was you, well, I'm not laughing at you, but don't.
No, we are laughing at you.
A little bit.
Look, I think it is an interesting tool that's used by Wilder to convey the passing of time, definitely the death of old Hollywood as Norma knew it, but I don't really feel there's enough depth for a creative response on the monkey.
Oh, God, no. I mean, the monkey really just symbolises this whole notion of extravagance. You know, rich people have, weird pets. You know, our recent example is Michael Jackson. He had a chimpanzee. Mike Tyson had a tiger, the more money you have and all of that equals extravagance. And so you've got the chimp as extravagance, who's dead, as is symbolic of Norma's career. You've got her beautiful car that is custom made and it's on blocks. And so that in itself has...
It's a trophy rather than a...
Yeah. The beautiful mansion as well. At the start, you see how it's, nice, even though it has a dead body in it in the pool. But at the beginning, after, like, Jeff, no, is it Jeff? I've got the wrong
we've
film.
Gone Rear Window for a minute, but that's okay.
Joe's tailing the narration, he goes back to the mansion and it's all decrepit and going gross with rats and stuff in the pool. That itself symbolizes her career. So all of these extravagant things that Wilder has included within the film are now gone, just like Norma's career, just like the silent film era, and that Hollywood is so fickle that it's never going to be certain for any of those stars that are within it.
And is her adoration, do you think, for the chimp, can you see that as perhaps paralleling her adoration in the sense that, like, so she adores this thing that is not human, and that thing dies. So perhaps there's a suggestion that it's her lack of humanity that's killed her presence as a star in the first place, or in the last place even.
And possibly even her own, like, love for herself.
Yes.
Like, she's so self-absorbed, and she doesn't realise that there is...
Is it her biggest, most authentic connection?
Probably not the biggest. No, I don't know.
I think she certainly portrays herself with an identity that can move from relationship to relationship. Not to imply that there's anything between Norma and the chimpanzee, but I think that it's important that she has something important in her life and she is able to fixate on one thing at a time, and that is her world. And we can see that in the way that she obsesses over Joe, in that she can then become so absorbed in what she is seeing as her pet project, perhaps. And in that instance, it was to ensure that she had a romantic relationship with Joe.
I like that, pet project.
Yeah.
Good choice of words there.
Should we shift gear a bit and talk about the sack? So hot takes on best approaches to finalising drafts, perhaps some statement of intention chat as well.
I just think it's important that students try and look at it in an original way without doing what everybody else is doing. Like, find a unique point in the film that isn't really explained and, you know, take that on board and be creative with it. You know, develop a character further that we don't have an understanding of. There's bits about Norma that we don't get. Give us some insight into how she became the way that she became. You know, you could do that with Joe as well, but we're all very much steer clear of Joe.
Well, he gives us so much in the narration, doesn't he?
Exactly.
And I think as well, like what you said about finding a point in the film, I feel like that gets missed sometimes. And students just come in with a bit of a stream of consciousness, internal monologue that doesn't actually land us in a particular point in time. So I think grounding yourself in the world of the film by really picking a moment or a gap that you can flesh out is it gives you a good foundation for a story that adds to the film rather than just a kind of, I don't know,
retelling. Yeah, the word I would go for.
Or even just like an additional.
The biggest mistake I find students do is they pick a scene and think that by retelling it from a different character's perspective
that's going to be enough, but that doesn't actually add anything to it.
So if that's the direction that you're going, maybe reconsider, well, what's missing in that scene that you can add to it that allows for you to be creative and explore a particular idea in more depth.
I even advise students that when they're going over their draft to consider highlighting as they go what parts of your story are original text, what parts are your new insights, and then whereabouts have you included figurative language or symbolism or things that make your writing interesting to make sure that you're covering all three of those areas and that you have a nice balance to your work.
Yeah, I think that's where those checklists come in handy. What's your advice on bringing imagery and symbolism into these stories? Is it imperative that students use symbols that already exist in the film?
If it fits, you know, they don't have to. But, you know, if they're talking about Joe, for example, I think it's important to talk about his car.
Yeah.
You know, and what that means to him. With Norma as well, maybe go into how she dresses.
Yeah, or mirrors.
Yeah, the mirrors.
The photographs.
Yeah.
So, you know, but little things like that I think are important.
I think as well, I've also had this conversation with my students about potentially, you know, if you think about some of the targets you've got to hit with the assessment criteria, you can bring in imagery that's evocative of the 1950s, for example, or a symbol that somehow represents, you know, celebrity that perhaps sits outside of the world of the film but is very much, can be very much located in the time and you can imagine would be in her mansion or in the car or...
And it will definitely make your writing of the statement much easier when you're writing up your written explanation of your work. If you have gone through this thought process more carefully about how you're constructing the language and what elements you're putting in, including symbolism, it will give you more to talk about rather than your statement turning into another
just a paraphrase.
Recap.
I think that's the biggest pitfall with the statement of intention is my story is about and then a summary of what happens in your story because we've already got that. what you need to do with your statement of intention is let us know sort of how you've done what you've done to create the world in your creative response.
Agreed.
Anything you want to add?
No, I think just feel free to share your draft around with your peers as well.
Yeah.
Try to get as much feedback as you can.
Yeah.
And then make sure that you keep trying to revise it as well as you can for the conditions of the actual assessment.
Just to be clear too, I want to make sure everyone knows this, and this is, if you're listening beyond the world of Kilvington, that's fantastic. but to our students, just remember that, you know, we can consult with you on one draft, but you're not going to get reams and reams of handwritten notes, because then it becomes our draft, not your draft, and VCAR doesn't like that.
No. And you know what? It takes away from the authenticity of your writing.
Yeah.
And we want to see what you write and what you're capable of. And I think that makes it more special when you do get your A or your B plus, whatever it is that is your best mark. You should be proud of that. So creative's hard.
I'm glad you can do it.
But they can do it. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
See you later.
Bye.